Hello and welcome once again to the Learning Digital Photography Podcast. You are listening to episode number 66, and the topic of this month's show is third generation cameras. We've brought Carrie Garrison on, so we've got a long conversation coming up. Make sure you got a long workout going on because this is going to take a while. All that's coming up in just a minute, so don't go away. Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and with me, as always, is the venerable Carrie Garrison. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
Good. How you doing? Hadn't talked to you in a while.
Good.
We've been both running around crazy the last couple weeks, couple months, actually. It's been a couple months since we talked. Did you have a good holiday? Did you have a good Christmas?
We did.
Good.
Kept it slow, kept it low, you know, had a good time.
Slow and low. That's the only way to take it. Well, we are talking to you today about this new hot topic that I think Trey Ratcliffe started the whole buzz going on with, this about these third generation cameras. There's been a lot of buzz about this since Trey first started talking about this over on his website, Stuck in Customs. Another big name, Robert Scoble, joined the conversation a while back too, and threw his two cents. And in between the two, they actually put some really good material together. But we haven't really seen anyone do a podcast on it, and Carrie and I were talking about this and said, hey, let's get a podcast out there. So I volunteered to be the guinea pig for the first official podcast that talks about third-generation cameras.
Well, if we're going to sit here and have a conversation about a topic like this, we might as well just hit record.
I did hit record.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Exactly. Right. Yeah, because we wanted to do some talking about it, and we said, all right, podcast time. Let's record.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, and we started doing our research. We were doing some independent, and then we shared some notes there. So we're going to be referencing a couple notes here. And I guess to start things off, to kind of prep the reader, it helps to have a little bit of background, right? I mean, I would think people were starting to hear this term third-generation camera. You know, when I first read it, I was like, WTF, you know, what happened to the first two generations? You know, I'm just like, how are they classifying this third generation? But after reading up on it and realizing – okay, yeah, this pretty much is a third generation for the digital camera field. I think that's an important distinction to make, because people were saying, well, there's, you know, tenotype, there's, you know, glass plate photography, there's film photography, there's, you know, and then you're in the fourth generation of photography if you're talking about it on that level. So what level are we really talking about? We're really talking about the third generation of digital photography. I don't know. Is that something that you'd seen as well in your research, Carrie?
I'd say something like that. I mean, we went from the early types that, you know, some of us used originally, you know, those early 1 megapixel cameras like the Kodak, EasyShare stuff, to, you know, the point and shoot style, and
sure,
then eventually to DSLRs.
Right.
And so maybe, you know, depending on how you look at it, you know, this could be a fourth generation. It's certainly an evolution.
That's a key word. It's not new.
It's not new. I mean, what we're talking about are these mirrorless cameras, if you've never heard that phrase before.
Right. Or the next gen, actually, is probably a good way to say it. The next generation of digital development. Because like you said, we started out with those early ones. You know, I think that's how a lot of us got into the DSLR market. I know that's how I got into it, when I started dinking around with point and shoots, and I just realized that these point and shoot ones, the thing for me, the big caveat for me with those was they didn't have the response time on the shutter. You know, I'd push the shutter and I'd have to wait 4 seconds for it to take a picture, and by then the moment's gone. I'm like, this isn't going to cut it for me. And that's when I moved into the DSLR range, because I wanted that quick response time. So that's what moved me to the, I guess, the second generation, today's generation that we all know and love so much, is the digital SLR. And like you said, now we're moving into this third one where they don't have the mirror anymore. And that's seeing a lot of changes, kind of leaps and advances in technology. When you get rid of the mechanical nature of it, when you get rid of all the physics of that, that opens up a lot more possibilities, because you don't have the mirror flip-flopping up and down, and you don't have to deal with that. And things have got advanced so rapidly that we really have an interesting time going on right now with all this quick maturation of the photography field. And if you think about it, from what, the early days of the 1800s, Carrie, when they first started doing the old pinhole camera stuff, way back in the day, back before any of us were doing this stuff, that was nothing compared to the changes that we see going on right now in the digital realm. you know, like Harry said, you had the low megapixel counts. These 1 megapixel cameras where you would have, you know, rasterization and jaggies, you know, these major deficiencies in tonal range because they really couldn't compete with film. You know, that to me was the first generation of digital cameras. Is that what you were thinking too, Kerry, for first gen cameras?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I remember those early ones with that. I mean, and this was funny because I got into digital photography when I was doing amateur rocketry and high speed radio control vehicles.
Right.
We could not do action photography. We had to literally stage it and fake it because the response time, by the time you're pressing the shutter and it takes the picture, the vehicle's gone.
That's why you were laughing when I just said that, because you're like, oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah,
that was freaking hilarious.
That was a stressful time for the digital shooters that don't even have to deal with that today. My, how much you're missing if you're just getting into photography today. So, yeah, that leads us to this new generation, this third generation, next generation, the mirrorless generation of cameras, you know, whatever nomenclature you want to give it or naming system you want to give it. That's entirely up to you. Trey Ratcliffe called it the third generation. Robert Scoble jumped on that bandwagon. That seems to be the trend. People are grabbing onto that as, I guess, the accepted standard for this next generation of cameras. So I think we'll probably just proceed with that semantic for the time being, since that seems to be what people are recognizing and comprehending, at least for the most part. So in framing that discussion, maybe we should talk about what this means. Like we talked about the mirrorless and how we're actually going to be losing the physical up and down slap of this mirror as we're going into the future. And Kerry and I are on video, so we're looking at each other and doing these motions and you can't see it, but we're talking about all these different things and all the different physics of it. And I think the first question really to ask, is it good or bad that we're losing this physical mirror slap that's going up and down?
You know,
and
it's kind of funny because we started without it, went right to it, and now the trend is to move away from it.
It's like a pendulum. It's always swinging back and forth. Exactly.
You know, and if you know, our point and shoot cameras don't have mirrors in them. They're direct to the sensor, so it's not that different. But one of the things that's very unique about this new breed of mirrorless cameras is the ability to have interchangeable lenses, the much larger sensor sizes, the same as we have in our DSLRs, very high megapixel rates, up 18, 24 megapixel cameras, the super high ISO performance that they're getting, all the things that we're used to having in our high-end DSLRs are now coming into this hybrid device that sits somewhere between a point-and-shoot and a DSLR with kind of the best of both worlds combined into one.
That's a great way to describe it. That's actually a term that I was thinking of inserting at some point as well. So we're obviously – and we haven't really talked much yet about this. We just said, hey, let's do a podcast on it. And our minds are right along the same path there because we're both thinking about this hybrid. You know, like that was just the way I was going to say it. It's a hybrid of the point and shoot and the DSLR where you have the best of both worlds. So in that vein, I guess the first question that we want to answer is not having a mirror a good thing? And in my mind, the answer to that is yes, because I think with the physical mirror, we were starting to bump up the limits in terms of frame rates of what you can get in terms of frame rates in a digital SLR with the mirror slapping up and down, because you can't get it to go much faster without being, I mean, just obscene, you know, and it was really starting to bump up physical limitations. So by getting rid of it, you're now allowing the digital side of the world to really take over. You know, it's no longer about the mechanics, it's about the digital. And I was reading one article that was talking about when you go to press the button on this new hybrid camera, you're actually getting a couple frames before you even really get the button all the way down. And, you know, it's getting, what would you say, 60 frames per second on one of these things? And
well, yeah,
80 frames, 120 frames a second. I saw one that was just, I mean, it was really obscene. I think it was like 240 frames a second.
Yeah, even the basic ones that, let's say the Sony NEX-5, which has been out for a while now.
Right.
It can do 1080i high def resolution at 60 frames per second.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just That's nothing the SLR category, or the DSLR, I should say. That's nothing the DSLR category could ever compete with. You know, it just couldn't do that. So I think that really is a solid yes, it's a good thing. Answer to that first question about not or about migrating away from the mirror.
Yeah, I mean, because look at our high end, if you want to call them those prosumer cameras, like a Canon 7D, for example.
Right.
It has a shutter that's rated for 150,000 actuations. Now, for most people, they may never come close to that. For some people, you know, maybe that's 10 years of use. For others, it's a year of use. And that is a physical piece that's moving and moving around and causing vibration and doing all these things because it's a bunch of metal moving around very quickly in your camera. It
right.
also has drawbacks in terms of shooting video, in that you have to get that up out of the way, and that's why a lot of our cameras today, that even though they shoot video, we don't have autofocus, and there's all these different trade-offs, if you will, because of having that system in there. And really, what we've done with DSLRs today is to take what was required of film cameras and slap digital backs on them to create a modern camera.
Exactly.
And so looking at where photography is going and imaging is going, I think it's definitely an interesting move to see how this is going to play out and whether they can get all of the benefits that we've had in DSLRs down into these smaller things. It's going to be weird if this becomes the trend and now we're walking around shooting weddings with these, like, you know, DSLR are there point and shoots on steroids, but, you know.
And that's one of the questions that I think was brought up in one of the articles I was reading is, you know, the impression that clients will have on your professionalism if you're showing up with something like this, and the client doesn't know any better, and do you really want to spend the time educating the client on what a third gen camera is versus a DSLR camera? Because impressions are still worth something. But yeah, just to kind of round out that discussion on the movement away from the mirror, and I think you hit on something there. The mechanism, which has always been this physical limitation, the analogy I thought of was hard drives.
Yeah.
You know, because we had these physical hard drives that were spinning faster and faster and faster, and we wanted to get it to read faster, and we couldn't because it was bumping up against this physical limitation. And what came out of that? Solid-state drives. And solid-state drives have become very common. I mean, a lot of systems are shipping with SSDs built in for the operating system.
MacBook Air, all these older books.
Yeah, and there's no moving parts. So, like you said, you have this shutter count actuation limit, 150,000 shutter releases, and then it might start to break down, or it will start to break down. If there's no moving parts, there's that much less that can break. Think about your car. You know, how many moving parts are there in a car? How many things can go wrong with a car? When there's no moving parts, that's a good thing because it means there's less
wear.
Possibility of wear and tear and breakage. Yeah, wear and tear breakage over time.
Still though, can you imagine going and shooting a 7200 or that Sigma 5500 with this thing the size of a postage stamp on the back end of it? That's just funny.
That's an interesting question. And that's one thing that I was actually thinking about is how will it look having this, you know, 7300 lens or this 5500 Sigma lens. You know, like you said, with the postage stamp on the back, I'm not sure you're going to be able to, actually, because in looking at the physics of it, when you look at these lenses, and this is a big question a lot of people have is what's going to happen with all my lenses? You know, I've spent hundreds of thousands, or not hundreds of thousands, you know,
definitely thousands.
Or maybe even tens of thousands, depending on how much you've invested in your photography thus far. But the point being, you've invested a lot of money in your lenses. Are you going to be able to use them? And I'm not sure you're going to be able to. I've seen some adapters out there, like for the Nikon 1 series. They've got the J1 and the V1. Then they have an adapter that looks like that will allow you to mount the new generation, I guess. I'll say new generation of lenses that allow you to put old lenses on this new generation camera back. And I'm calling it a camera back because I really think that's what it is. It's just a camera back. It's not really a camera anymore because we all know it's the lenses that – really define the quality of the image these days anyway. So yeah, it looks like you might not even be using that 50 to 500. I don't know. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Do you really think that the physics would work there? I'm not even sure how that would work. I
You
see the
know, I
adapters, but I
see the
don't see.
adapters, absolutely. And it's the same sensor. There were both, my DSLR and some of these mirrorless are both using APS-C size sensors. So
Yep.
as long as they can have the adapter have that correct distance from the back of the lens to the sensor, there's no reason why some of this stuff isn't going to work.
Yeah.
It may be weird, but it can certainly work.
It should work, yeah. And it was the whole interesting thing about that. I read a really good piece. I wish I could remember these links. I should probably put these links up in the show notes, but there was one article that taught that showed, and I'm holding this up to Carrie, but it showed you the distance from the back of the last element to the mount for a regular, crop size sensor for an SLR, and then it showed the back for these new ones, and it's like one third the distance. And it was explaining this is why you can't just slap a current generation lens on one of these new generation cameras because the focusing point, it'll go past the back of the camera
Right.
when it pulls it into sharp focus. So that's why it won't just natively attach because of the way the focusing angles work on those optics. The focusing point will go behind where the existing camera is. And maybe we'll include some graphics when we throw this podcast up so people can see what we're talking about here. So those adapters, all they're really doing is they're pushing the camera far enough forward so that it'll come into focus right where it meets that sensor plane. So that's probably a helpful explanation there. Whether or not you want to continue to use those, because I would imagine as the camera technology is increasing, so too will the lens technology. I mean, look at the Nikon one. The Nikon family already has, what, four or five lenses in their new generation cameras?
Yeah.
They've got like a 10 to 30, a 10 mil, a 100 mil. I mean, all these different lenses. Are you going to need your old lenses? Are they going to produce the same quality optics? Because if you look at a new generation lens and a new generation body, what kind of optics is that going to produce versus a new generation body and an old generation lens? It's like you're trying to retrofit something, and is that really made to work? I mean, will that work as well
Well,
as.
a lot of it remains to be seen, and
Sure.
whether or not they can get the same results out of them that we're getting out of DSLRs today.
Right.
And typically there are a few issues. It's the same sensor as I mentioned before, so we have massive megapixels in some of these. The one that's the probably the newest kid on the block is going to be the Sony NEX7, and this thing is starting at 24 megapixels, and
It's amazing.
they'll have a 36 megapixel one coming out next year as a full frame. I mean, that's unfreaking believable.
It
Okay.
really is amazing.
It's extremely responsive shutter release. Okay. There's a nice little advantage. You have focus peaking and things that we can't do with a DSLR. That's very cool.
Yeah.
The autofocus, that seems to be the sticking point with these things. They just don't seem to have the speed of the autofocus that we enjoy in our cameras today.
So I guess here's the question, because we were talking about all these different facets and aspects where we're talking about no mirror and the autofocus and new lens sizes and sensor sizes, and you kind of quickly brushed over all the points of those to show why, it's really not as much of a factor, but that autofocus factor is a really good one. And my question to you then is, because right now we're talking at the beginning of the third generation of these, right? So do you think because I'm thinking just the nature of technology, like when we looked at the first clunky digital ones where there was like a 4 second delay before you took the picture, we're talking about the same kind of the same issue here when it comes to autofocus, where it's not autofocusing quick enough. I'm guessing by the end of the year or maybe the beginning of 2013, that autofocusing issue really will become moot.
I have to believe that it will. I mean, this is new technology, and obviously the priorities have been picture quality. It's got to have that. It's
Right.
been ISO performance. It's got to have that. It's been making sure that the video stuff is, dead on, which in these new ones it absolutely is. Keeping everything lightweight, the lenses. So things like you know, the speed of autofocus. Well, most people say it's adequate. Well, do you want adequate or do you want awesome? You know, and
I think that's what's going to actually keep a lot of professionals in the SLR category for the time being, because they don't want adequate when they're out shooting these at these client sites.
Right.
And that's what's going to keep a lot of people behind for maybe the second iteration of these third generation cameras or third gen, you know, 3.1 or 3.2. You know, look for the .1 release of these cameras, and that's when you might see some of the professionals start to migrate from the SLR market to this third generation market.
And I think a lot of that's going to be dependent on usage as well.
Sure.
I absolutely think that things like landscape, you know, nature photography, where there really is none of that client expectation, or you know, that having to look the part per se is relevant. You know, studio work, a lot. There's going to be a lot of applications where, sure, you can take these. And I know for myself, I'm always torn between, do I not take a camera somewhere because my DSLR is just too heavy to take, because I don't carry around a point and shoot, because I've never been happy with them, you know?
Right.
And I look at it going, well, gosh, you know, should I buy a, you know, Canon, you know, G9, and then it was the G10, and then it was the G11, and then, you know, it went from 400 to 600.
Don't forget the G12.
Yeah, you know, now those cameras are up to like $800-$900, and a good mirrorless one like the NEX7 is going to be in like the $1,500 price range.
Right.
I mean, that's the cost of a prosumer DSLR. And
right.
So it's a big balance there to go, well, that's a lot of money for this type of camera, but would I have a use for it? Is it a good camera to haul around for my day-to-day, you know, in my pocket one, which it absolutely seems like it is.
Sure.
You know,
I think what a lot of people may be doing, and this, we're kind of jumping around on our talking points here, going from one area to another, but yeah, you kind of hit on something that I was experiencing the same thing with. I was debating for a long time between the Canon G9, 10, 11, 12, and looking at the cost escalating up, and said, you know what, if I'm going to get one of those, I may as well just get the next generation SLR. And then we started seeing the third generation. So I think for a lot of people, that question is, should I get into this? And it sounds like you're saying you're kind of on the fence right now.
I'm on the fence because, you know, I'm trying to figure out what all other uses I would have for something like this. And there's a number of areas where one of these, I think, would come in extremely handy. First off, as a second camera, you know, if I'm shooting a wedding, I could just set one up somewhere and just let it sit there and go, you know, as a backup camera, it's certainly a good choice for just stashing away in an unobtrusive location during a wedding or some other event would be interesting. Aerial photography. These things are huge in aerial photography because
they're
don't
so
need super heavy, I mean, massive helicopters and things to lift them. I mean, they're so light that you can do some really interesting things with.
Have you seen the weights on these?
They're under a pound.
Yeah.
It depends on the lens. I mean, you can get some big, heavy lenses on these things. But
sure, but even with the new generation of these third gen cameras and lenses attached, they're still, I would say, a fraction of the weight of the equivalent in the DSLR market.
There's no question.
You know, it's night and day, and these things are getting so light and so portable. I think what a lot of consumers, and this kind of leads to the last point that we were going to be talking about, but I'll go ahead and jump in with that now, and I just held something up for Carrie as kind of my middle-of-the-road answer here, and I think it's going to be the case for a lot of people, where if you have a current-generation smartphone, the image quality that you get off of those is pretty reasonable as far as expectations go, and you really probably – I think what a lot of people are going to do is say, you know what, this will work for now, because a lot of people are going to recognize, you know, knowing that technology is going to improve. This is the first generation of these. It's only going to get better. Why jump in now when the cost is relatively high for these third generation cameras? Because as technology improves, guess what happens? The price starts to drop too. You know, that's the inevitable trend in anything, in anything tech anyway, whether it's a computer or a router or a monitor or a TV or, in this case, photography. You know, as the cost of the technology becomes more affordable to the camera vendors, it's going to, we'll see that reflected in the cameras that we get. So I think this first generation one, because like you said, they're pretty pricey. I mean, even looking at the Nikon series, they've got that J1 for $650. You're talking an entry-level SLR. They've got the V1 for $1,000. That's probably a prosumer model SLR there. The $1,600 Sony NEX, same kind of thing, like you were talking about. You know, this isn't chump change.
No,
but I think the price is going to drop with time. You know, as the technology advances and they start getting faster frame rates and better ISO handling, better low light performance of these kinds of things. You know, as that tends to happen, so too does go the nature of technology. Price will drop. You know, more competitors are going to be entering this marketplace, I think, because they don't have to deal with the assembly line plants and building all these mirrors and all these different parts and components that went with the second generation, or excuse me, the DSLR generation. You know, there's going to be less production required. And with less production requirements comes a lower cost to scale these things out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think that's just going to be what happens in the nature of this thing as we move forward, where the technology gets better, the price goes down. Everybody wins, whether it's the consumer, the prosumer, or the professional.
I mean, you look at it, look at the market today. I mean, when I go to things like soccer games or, you know, family events, how many people are still pulling out camcorders?
Yeah.
I mean, it's nobody. They're doing most of their video with their smartphone. Now, right. A lot of them will have point and shoots or DSLRs or something for their photography, but their smartphone has generally replaced the camcorder because they went from a standard definition camcorder to an HD resolution phone.
Right.
It's silly.
And like, you know, that's just further proof of the nature of the technology. You know, the nature of the beast is it's always going to be improving. It's always going to be getting better. You know, for those of us that might not have the resources to jump in and be, you know, the early adopters, so to speak, you know, you probably don't need to be an early adopter in the first generation one. And the camera vendors are going to hate me for saying that. You know, there goes my Canon endorsement, I guess, you know, for when Canon comes out with one of these things. But it's the nature of the beast. Do you want to be an early adopter and spend $1,600 on something that probably in a year you won't be able to sell for $400?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, look, every time a new camera comes out, the previous model drops in price, and that's just the way it goes. So you're either jumping on the bandwagon and getting it because it has some new crazy cool feature that you want, or, you know, whatever it is. And in my case, I usually wait till a camera is, I kind of skip a generation. I had the 10 or the 20D, the 30D. I skipped the 40D. I went to the 50D. Then I went to the 7D. And so I'm always, you know, I'm not. The 7D Mark II, I better run out and get it. Or the 5D Mark III, I better run out and get it. I'm okay to wait a little bit because my equipment works really well for me. But it also allows me to afford stuff a little bit better because I'm not buying stuff when it first comes out and is at the peak of its price point.
Yeah.
And, you know, now maybe it's because I'm a cheap bastard.
Well, if you're cheap, I'm super cheap, because when you said you go every other generation, I'm usually going about every third generation, and you hit it spot on. Carrie, you guys didn't see this, but I just pointed at my nose at Carrie saying, spot on the money. If you're current, and here's my bar where I'm going to set the standard as to whether or not I'm going to change out of my gear. If my current gear works for me, what's the point? You know, what's the point in jumping on the bandwagon, like you said, to go to the next generation, whether it's the Nikon one or the Sony NX or the Leica? And I'm hoping Canon comes out with something. You know, I'm sure they'll join the fray here soon enough. But, you know, it's like, even if they do, and the first generation Canon or the third generation Canon, camera comes out, I'm probably not going to get it. I just don't think a first generation first iteration of this third generation camera is really worth jumping on, unless you're an uber geek and you got to have the latest and greatest. I can't see a justification for it, either from a cost perspective or from the advances in frame rates.
Yep, but
I really don't see that.
Maybe you and I are looking at this from the wrong angle, because we're coming from the DSLR world. And saying, okay, why would we go down this path? And I think probably more so than anything else, the path is going to be the point and shoot people who have traditionally at this point gone into the Rebel, you know, or the 60D or, you know, the Canon D90, because that was the next progression from a point and shoot camera to have better image quality, to be able to do some of those things and to have interchangeable lenses. And right. yet they get these cameras and they're never taken off automatic mode, and they're, you know, they're
the professional mode.
In the vast majority of cases, they never even buy anything other than the kit lens.
Right.
And so why jump into the complexity and, you know, some of the issues involved with a DSLR when you can go from that point and shoot world to a mirrorless system, get a lot, if not almost all, of the advantages of a DSLR, but in something that's a lot easier, a lot smaller, a little more affordable. I mean, throw out all those things. I mean, for the few things that they're not up to par with the DSLRs for, and that will change.
You know, it's going to, sure.
This is a great in between that point and shoot and the DSLR category.
Right. And I think you hit it spot on there as well, because a lot of people are going to be looking at this from a natural progression perspective. And for current SLR owners, probably not a natural progression, because you've already got equipment that will work for you in most scenarios. This is really designed for the next generation, right? The people who are getting into photography moving forward, the kids coming out of high school, or the new mom and dad that finally got their kid off to grade school and they can be like, you know what, let's go get a new camera so we can document these memories. And they're looking at the options available, point and shoot for $100 or $50, whatever they're going now. I don't even price point and shoots anymore. I don't know what they're at. Versus an SLR for $800 versus one of these third gen mirrorless cameras that it's kind of like the point and shoot, like you said. You know, it's got about the same weight. Maybe it's a little bit heavier, but it's got a lot more features, and it's only a couple hundred more dollars. And in today's day and age, $100. I mean, you drop that on a dinner. You know, it's not something you really think as much about as you used to. At least I don't anymore. I don't know if it's the same all around, because let's face it, the economy is what it is. So some people may still be saying $100 is a lot of money, and it is. But when you're entering these kinds of fields where you're working with photography and you're working with computers and all this technology, the gap from the point-and-shoot to these mirrorless cameras is not nearly as much as some might think when you look at the scale of the photography industry. I mean, like we said at the beginning, you know, how much have we spent on our photography gear over the last 10 years? I don't even want to price that out. If I priced that out, my wife would kill me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the kind of on that kind of scale, but then you look at the cost of entry for these third generation, it's really no different.
But you know, let's also take a step back here. I mean, we've been talking a lot about the like the one that's really caught my eye, because it has some really amazing features, and that's the Sony NEX-7. But a lot of people probably don't realize that this technology has been around for a while. If you remember all the hoopla about the Micro Four Thirds cameras, and right. those are mirrorless cameras. And was it last year or the year before, there was this fantastic TV commercial for the Olympus EP1, the pen camera, where they shot this beautiful commercial, and then they turned the camera around and they're shooting it with this Olympus EP1.
Right.
And
I remember that.
That was only a 12-megapixel camera. Now, we say only a 12-megapixel camera, but 12-megapixel camera is still a lot of freaking megapixels, you know?
Right.
And
right.
if you look at that camera today, it's $400.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
– Oh, yeah.
It's nothing, you know, in comparison to, you know,
relative
a,
to the photography
T2i.
Industry.
You
right.
know, you're going to go to Costco and get a T2i kit for $900. You know, you can get an Olympus EP1 – for $395, and so you already seen those first round mirrorless cameras plummeting in price.
Who made that again? Who made that one?
The Olympus EP.
Olympus. One. Olympus. I'm adding that to the show notes, so that's why I had to pause, because I was like, oh crap, I forget who even did that. Yeah, and that was big last year. I remember when I saw that commercial and I saw him turn around and look in the mirror and it showed the pen. I was like, oh my God, is that what he shot that
with? I had to go back, and I had just bought, because I remember this, because I had just bought my 55-inch LCD, and that commercial came on, and I'm on my DVR just going through going, okay, is there any pixelization? I want to see how good this is. This thing really scaling well on a 55-inch LCD? And, yeah, there was a couple little quirks in it, but overall that picture was amazing.
Right.
And we're talking a $400 camera today.
Yeah. It's shot, and that's just further evidence of what the trend is going to be, because you're going to see these trends continue to happen. Technologies will advance, more features going to come into play. That $400 camera that was 12 megapixels going to become the next $700 camera that's 24 megapixels.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just going to increase the viability and the usability of these kinds of things moving forward. Look at the GoPros. I see people wearing those everywhere, capturing live video. And Carrie and I have talked about this in the past with these GoPros. There's amazing quality, HD video coming from this little tiny thing. You know, it's like an inch wide by a quarter of an inch tall. When they first came out, we're just like, yeah. How good is it going to be? And then we started seeing some of the video quality from this, and we're like, oh my God, that's really awesome quality. And the same kind of thing is transcending here in these mirrorless cameras, because if you look at their frame rates are basically video, if not more, if not faster than that. You know, because what, standard video frame rates, I think, are 30 frames per second or
29.4. 24%, yeah.
Yeah, 24 to 30, depending on where you on different formats there. But if you're looking at a 24 to 30 frame rate for video, and a still camera is shooting 60 frames per second, you're getting video.
Yeah.
You know, that is video right there. The interesting thing that I'm going to throw in here that I didn't have in the show notes, so I'm kind of blindsiding Carrie. He's probably going to throw a different finger at me than what he's been using thus far, going, hey, at this point. But here's the question I have, is about post-production. You know, what's the impact going to be on post-production for – the prosumer, the enthusiast, or even the professional moving forward, where instead of finding the best one shot in 20, you're having to go through the best one shot in 200, you know, because you're getting all these different frames, even if you don't want that.
Well, you know, I think that's changing. You know, some of the technology that we're seeing in these cameras is truly amazing. And in fact, some of the – gosh, what's that other camera that's coming out soon? It looks like a little cube, but it does all the light rays.
Oh.
You can basically focus in post. You
know? Right.
And so we're going to see more and more
things. No depth of field. Yeah.
Yeah. But really, when you're shooting these, generally we're getting 10 frames per second with these cameras today. So it's not that much different than what we're dealing with today. And like I said, the main issue being autofocus and
the Lytro.
The Lytro camera, yeah. Boy, that's going to be an interesting one. See how that one plays out. So I'm not sure that it's a big difference in post. I mean, if you're in single shot mode, you're still only going to have one picture. But that shutter lag, that's the key. The Sony NEX7 is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records for the fastest shutter lag. You know?
Okay, sorry.
0.02 seconds.
When you said the fastest shutter lag, yeah. I had to think about that for a second.
The shortest.
It's kind of an interesting concept. The fastest or the shortest shutter lag means there's that little of a lag between when you press the shutter down and it starts taking the first picture.
Mm-hmm.
And would you say it was 0.0?
It's 0.02.
0.02 seconds.
Yeah.
That is 0.02 of a second. Most people don't even blink that fast.
No, you don't. And, again, I really don't like using the NEX7 as an example, because it's absolutely brand spanking new. It's $1,600, with a lens. But if you go back one generation, there was no NEX6. I don't know why. But if you go back one generation to the NEX5, you're talking a body. It came with that 1855 what they call the pancake lens.
The pancake lens,
which is really cool. That got you 16.1 megapixels, 1080p, 60 frames per second, HD movie capture, 10 frames per second, all those same things, except all the Sony E-mount lenses, and you can buy that as a kit for about $700.
$700. I don't even want to think about it because I know what my first kit cost me. It was more than that. So welcome back, folks. Sorry for the technical difficulties there. One of us lost our internet, but we won't say who, will we, Carrie?
It was me.
I said we won't say who, will we, Carrie? You should have just said, no, that's right, we won't.
No, Time Warner in Southern California went down for a few moments, but I'm not going to bitch at anything. So when we I don't know how much of that we got, but we had been talking about the NEX 5 being down to the $700 price range with that.
Right, that's about 55. Where it cut off. That's where we got cut off there. So just jumping back on that bandwagon – well, I shouldn't say bandwagon, but on that topic – that $700 price point, I think that was one of the last things I had mentioned, was that that's about what my first kit cost in the SLR category.
Well, what I was going to follow up with that is, have you been looking at the prices of some of the add-on lenses for these?
I had looked up the prices on the Nikon series and then the – which ones? Let's see. There was – okay, for the Nikon 1 series, they have two cameras. The J1 is $650. The V1 is $900. Then I couldn't find a price on their 10 to 30 mil, but then their other lenses are $250, $250, and $750. And then for the Sony NEX, the two native lenses I saw was a 16 millimeter lens and 18 to 55 millimeter lens, and both of those I think were $250.
So that's actually pretty good prices when you look at what we would pay for a Canon lens.
Absolutely. When I looked at a Nifty 50 for Canon, the F28, and one of these is an F28, I forget which one it is. It's the Nikon 10mm F28 is going for $250. A 50mm F28, you know, when you get down to 10mm, it's even that much more difficult with the optics to get that kind of aperture value in the traditional DSLR market. But the 2.8 for a 50mm Canon brand, I think, is like $500.
Oh, yeah.
Like $450, $500. Am I close there in the price point? I don't even remember what the price point is.
You're definitely right about there.
But I was just like, you know, that's a lot of money when I've got two lenses that already hit that focal length. And I was like, I don't know if I really want to justify that. For $250, though, you know, to me it seems like it's kind of a no-brainer. You know, because you can probably buy into this new generation, this third generation of mirrorless lenses, and get the same kind of kit that we have for, I'd say, a third of the cost of what we paid in the DSLR market.
I'd have to say that's pretty accurate. And that's why I think from the consumer side, these are just going to be phenomenal, phenomenal cameras.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And that kind of leads into our last point, or our last topic of the discussion today, is where does that leave the consumer? You know, when you look at the options that are available, because right now the consumer has an interesting set of options, right? They've got the smartphones, you know, your Android phones and your Apple phones and your Samsung phones, or, you know,
which take good pictures
and even take decent video. You know, if you want to upload a video to Facebook, you know, that you saw Pokemon at the grocery store and a little video of Pokemon jumping up and down in the grocery aisle, because I actually did that with my camera phone a couple months ago. They had these little Hoops and Yo-Yo characters from the Hallmark cards, you know, walking through the store in these little outfits. And I was like, well, that's kind of funny. I'll take a video of that. And I took a little video on my phone. And I uploaded that video to Facebook, under my personal Facebook account, to share with family and friends. And people were like, that was amazing quality video. What'd you record that on? And it was my phone. So, yeah. You know, you have this interesting cross-section of options to choose from. You've got your phones. You've got your smartphones, which are decent. You've got the point-and-shoot cameras.
Okay. Well, you
know
what?
You've got the SLRs and now this new generation.
While we're going through that, why don't we do a little – pro-con real quick on
good idea,
you know, starting
good
up idea. There and if we're
so
gonna start
smartphone it, pro-con
okay I think you know absolutely the pro for most people is you always have it with you, you know. I mean, it's there, it's in your phone, you know, easy upload, you've got your internet access built in, all that good stuff. I think that's a great advantage to those. The downside is there's no, I mean, other than these weird bolt-on, snap-on, tape-on, you know, lenses, you don't have interchangeable lenses.
You have
what's called a rolling shutter. And instead of, you know, the whole thing turning on and off, or the physical shutter going off, it reads across the sensor just like an old TV would draw from top to bottom. And right. So you can't take pictures of things that are moving quickly, because the object will move from the time it starts at the top of the sensor and by the time it gets to the bottom, and you get this weird wave going through the image. Right. So that, and the GoPros actually suffer from that as well. And so that's when you have that rolling shutter issue, you know, you're very limited in the types of photography that you can take.
Right. I've got another con for you too on the smartphones that I've always just, it has been a bugaboo for me, has been the fact that you can't adjust the aperture.
Aperture, I mean, exposure to an extent, but it's kind of fake, you know.
Yeah.
Aperture, well, shutter speed, ISO, I can't adjust any of those.
We're talking about the cons right now, obviously, of these smartphones. The pros, I think you mentioned very well, you brought up the big ones. I think the other big one is the cost point, you know, because if you're buying these as part of your cellular agreement, you know, I just got the iPhone, you know, I upgraded to that for $6, and that was the joke, because I snuck through a crack in the Verizon pricing scheme and got into this smartphone for $6. But even at $200, for the quality of images I think that come out from smartphones, $200 is not a bad price.
Or if you look at it another way, it's free because you bought the phone.
Right.
If you're buying the phone for the phone features, and they're thrown in the camera,
right?
That's another way of looking
at
it.
Added bonus, yeah, yeah. It's just another benefit, I guess, of having a smartphone is, hey, you get a camera built in. Woohoo!
Yeah.
I think that's becoming the expectation more than the exception, though, is you're going to have some camera and video capabilities and upload to Facebook. And I really think that's defining the pro and the con, it's also helpful to define the expectation. You know, the pro is you get decent enough pictures, you get decent enough video for Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think these phones, although I do know Chase Jarvis did a book with photos taken from his iPhone, you know, being, I think the title was The Best Camera is the One You Have With You, or
yeah,
the best camera. It was just the best camera. But anyway,
I'll tell you, I'm going to be honest with you here for just a second.
Uh-oh.
There are product shots that I have done on my websites that have been taken with either my phone or with my Motorola Zoom tablet.
So here's the thing. When you've taken those shots, have you or have you not in some way stabilized that camera?
No.
You've done it handheld.
Yeah. But I may have turned on my big fluorescent studio lights.
I was about to say, has it been lit?
It was either outdoors or it was lit.
Sure.
But I'm not going to admit which images they are, because they turned out extremely well. But I was like, man, I need to take a shot real quick.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point though, because in the right conditions, you know, if the lighting is right, if you know the conditions permit it, these phone cameras really do a kick butt job.
They do. They do a fantastic job.
They've got their place, or they've got their niche, I should say, in the wider marketplace of photography.
Oh, and I can take that image, and right there on my tablet, I mean, I could go crazy with Photoshop Touch, but I can rotate it.
Photoshop Express, exactly.
I like Photoshop Touch. It's really sweet. It's a step above that. But I don't even use that. Basically, all I'm going to do is I'm going to crop it, resize it, and then I hit one key, it puts it on Dropbox, I go to my desktop, I drag it to my website, I'm done.
Right.
You know, I cannot do that with my DSLR.
All right. Yeah, the plug-and-play aspect, I think, of the smartphone category of phones – of cameras, I should say. The smartphone category of cameras is – and the ease of use, I think, is a big part of what we're getting at here. It's very easy to use. It's very easy to take your pictures with you no matter where you go, whether you're going from your camera to your website, your camera to Facebook, or anything like that.
Okay, so kind of the next step is the the point and shoot cameras. And
right, the point and shoot. Okay, pros and cons. So, and when we're talking point and shoot cameras, let's frame this a little bit. The point and shoot cameras are what category? How would you classify a point and shoot these days?
I would say it's a integrated camera without interchangeable lenses. No real viewfinder other than the LCD on the back. These are the kind of the next step up from your camera without going into these other ones we've already talked about.
So there's no so we can itemize this. There's going to be no interchangeable lens, no viewfinder, but it's a step up from the smartphone, so there's no phone either.
Right.
There's no phone, there's no email, there's no that kind of stuff. It's a dedicated camera.
But you're getting higher resolution.
Higher resolution, higher megapixel count probably.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Better quality video on the ones that shoot video.
A larger sensor.
Larger sensors. And you're getting typically a real flash versus an LED going off.
Right. Although some of these LEDs, have you downloaded a flashlight app lately?
The one on my tablet's pretty freaking bright, but it is nowhere near as bright as a flashbulb going off.
This is true, but I do have to interject something there about those LED flashlights, because I haven't just gotten this iPhone, of course, but I'm very impressed with how bright that is relative to my previous generation phone's flash.
Yeah, but it doesn't stop. It's not fast enough that it stops. It's not bright enough that it stops action.
Correct. And that's where the big limiting factor is. So yeah, I think you're right in that a point-and-shoot camera will have a true dedicated flash.
And that allows you to take action photos. It allows you to take stuff when it's darker and be able to have a wider spread of light. So there's some good advantages to the point-and-shoots.
And I think for an example in this category, I'd throw out the Canon G12.
You know, it's interesting from the G10, 11, and 12, because what separated those is that they actually had the hot shoe that you could use Canon's 580EX flashes.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting hybrid, and yet that's pretty rare to see a hot shoe on a point and shoot. But some of the higher end ones have them.
You're right. I should probably rethink that as an example. So what would you throw out as an example then of a standard point and shoot camera these days?
I think anything that's called an easy share or a
how about the power shot? Well, there's other Canon power shots. There's other Canon power shots out there, because we talk about the G9, 10, 11, 12. These are all part of the power shot family of cameras, but there are other cameras in that power shot family that do classify as point and shoot cameras, and we can look this up and add it to the show notes here. So if you look at the Canon website for power shot cameras, they're going to have a whole myriad of cameras there. And in the time I just mentioned that to you, I was able to pull up the PowerShot G1X, G12, PowerShot S100, S95, SX40, and all of these are in the $400 and less. And then you go down to the SX260, the 230, the 150, and you know they just keep going lower and lower in price.
It's mind-boggling.
If
you go into a Best Buy or Micro Center or someplace like that, they've got point-and-shoot cameras from $75 to $800.
Yep.
And the whole range, and it's features.
The Elf is another one in the Canon family.
Great camera.
Since we're both Canon shooters, we'll probably stick with the Canon one because we know that one the best. But yeah, the PowerShot Elf is a great camera. The 530 series all the way down to the 100 series, that's $179. And then you get into the A series, and I remember that was my first point and shoot camera that I was actually semi happy with, was the PowerShot. I think the A500 or the AS500 or something like that. And now they've got their cheapest one is $89. It's the PowerShot A800. So the Canon PowerShot A800 I would classify as a true point and shoot. It goes for $90. What do you think the megapixel count is on this?
I'm going to say 12.
10.
I was close.
You were close. 10 to 12 is the average range, I think. And it has the typical limitations that we were talking about. So you can't change lenses on it. It does have a dedicated flash. You can catch sports and action types of shots in this, but it will come with those limitations that we had mentioned as well. So, yeah, so that's the point-and-shoot category. Pros on this category.
Now, are most of those still CCD sensors, or I think almost all of them
are CCD sensors.
And that's going to be kind of the, I think, another issue there, is when you get into really high speed things, you may still have some of that rolling shutter issue that we talked about before. Right. You don't get into the CMOS sensors until you start getting into those mirrorless and the DSLRs.
Right. And then the other thing I'd also throw in for this point and shoot category is related to the sensor size and the megapixel count. And I think this is part of the reason why we started to see this transition towards this third generation of cameras, because the size of the sensor, the CCD size sensor in these point and shoots, and the ginormous megapixel counts that they were getting was actually starting to see a decreasing amount of return on investment there, where the more pixels you threw on there, the more grainy your shots actually looked, because you got more pixelization. And I don't know if that's the right word to use or not.
Good word.
50-cent word. But so it was a diminishing returns on that, where because the sensor was still so small relative to the megapixel count, your image quality really wasn't getting that much better. People started to recognize that, and you actually saw pixel or megapixel counts go down.
Yeah, from the G10 to the G11.
Yeah, so you're seeing them go down, but you're seeing the quality of the imagery actually went up in that vein, because the quality of the bokeh and the – anyway, we won't get into the techniques of it.
Okay, but what are some of the downsides?
And that's one of them, is I would say the correlation between megapixel count and sensor size cause a lot of image quality issues. So introductory users would get frustrated very easily, because it was hard to get decent quality shots when you're looking at them full size.
Yeah. Now, apart from the high-end ones like the Canon G11s and stuff, most of them don't shoot RAW. They shoot JPEG. So your image processing is going to be a little more limited, so they're not going to have the dynamic range that a higher-end camera is going to have. Obviously, no interchangeable lenses. We already talked about that being a key differentiator. And there's still going to be some shutter lag. You press that shutter, and there's a small delay between
still
it.
Still some.
It's not as bad as it used to be, but there's still some, and it can be frustrating for some people. Most people these days, it's acceptable, and acceptable is a good place to be.
Right. I think the shutter lag is about the same in the point and shoot category as your smartphone category. So if you're moving to a point and shoot, it's not to get rid of the shutter lag. It's to get a higher megapixel count or a better quality image than what your camera phone did. And possibly have a dedicated flash, and you know, all these things we've already talked about. I guess the other aspect of it that I would throw in as a pro is that it is something that you can take with you almost anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess the same would hold for camera phones too. So that same upside still exists in a very small form factor. And I think you also have more accessories for that, because I know for the longest time, one of the things I was looking at, trying to find anyway for the Android system, was some kind of tripod that I could mount the camera on.
Yeah.
You know, just to put it up in some small place. And I saw all these DIY hacks out there and this and that. Then they came out with one for the iPhone, and they modded that to make that work for the Android system. But on these point-and-shoot cameras, they have that dedicated, a quarter-inch thread in the bottom that most GorillaPods, most tripods, you know, you can fit it on that. So if you do need to set it up to have some added stability, you can do that. You can take the 30-second photo if you're going to be in a position or a place where that you're capable of doing that, and not have to lug out an SLR with its big 18 to 55, 70 to 200, whatever lens you're using. You can still do that. You still have the capability of setting it up, locking it down, and putting it in a place where you can get some better shots. So what other pros and cons do you see, Carrie, from
I think we've covered it on those pretty well.
Okay, so that's the point-and-shoot category. The next category up then, because we're talking about these four different categories and what the consumer can consider when making their purchasing decisions, is the SLR category. And I think we probably will hammer this out pretty quickly as well. We know the biggest advantage is the ability to change lenses, right? Because that's the whole principle of the SLR camera, the single lens reflex camera, is you can swap out multiple lenses. You can go from a wide angle camera to a long zoom camera with just a swap of a lens.
And the vast array of available lenses.
Right. And there's, and I think that's a limitation in the next one, but we'll get to that in a minute. So, you know, the huge number of options available from having multiple lenses available. And that's regardless of vendor. It doesn't matter whether you're a Canon, Nikon, Pentax, Olympus, you know, whoever. Sony, I forget who else, who haven't I mentioned out there. They all have them. That's the upshot here, is they all have so many options available, and even through third-party lenses. I've done a lot of work with Sigma in the past. You know, it's not just the camera vendors. There's so many options out there. I think higher ISO is another big one in the SLR category. Mm-hmm. You get a lot wider range in terms of ISO handling. And then, of course, as the camera gets bigger, what else is getting bigger? The sensor on that too, right? Mm-hmm. So as the sensor gets bigger, you're going to be able to accommodate more megapixels and retain that image quality, or even have it a higher image quality, more raw capabilities than you had in the point-and-shoot category. Carrie, jump in here if you've got other ideas.
I'm going to go for it here, and I'm going to say the ability to do creative lighting.
Yep.
Because your point-and-shoot...
Yep.
Okay. With the exception of the Canon G10, 11, 12s that have the hot shoe on them that work with Canon's TTL system, mm-hmm. you with regardless of the point and shoots or the mirrorless systems, you cannot add
external
flashes to these so that you can do off-camera lighting with studio portrait setups. And I think that probably a long time is going to be the thing that really separates the professionals from being able to go down to the mirrorless cameras until, of course, Canon comes out with one that has a hot shoe on it, and that just blows my theory right out of the water.
Well, here's the other question for you is whether or not this – and this probably gets back to the third generation one that we'll bring up in just a minute. You know, I'll hold off on that question. Remind me of the off-camera flash question when we get to the third-gen cameras, because that's something I want to bounce off you to see what your thoughts are here as well. So, yeah, that pretty much wraps up the digital SLR category. So let's just go ahead and segue.
Well, except for the downsides.
Oh, okay, yeah, the downsides. So what are the downsides to the SLRs? I think cost is a big one for a lot of people. There's a barrier to entry.
Absolutely.
The bulk, I think, is an issue for a lot of people where, you know, you just don't want to lug around 10 pounds of camera gear. You know, especially in my current job, I think that's an ideal situation where I'm doing a lot of traveling and I would love to have a really good camera with me.
I'm going to
but
say
I just don't have room.
The lack of a stealth feature.
Lack of stealth, yes.
Lack of stealth, yeah.
Stealth, non-existent.
I cannot take my camera with my lenses into certain venues because they go, you can't come here because that's a professional camera.
Right.
It's like, what does that have to do with anything? You know, anyone off the street can buy this camera. Well, you can't use that camera here. But I could take a mirrorless camera. I could take any other camera.
You can take a G12 in there.
But you can't take that camera.
Right.
And so there's that stealth mode that, you know, you just can't take that camera certain places.
Right. And you know what the funny thing is I see people taking shots during takeoff in planes. Mm-hmm. It's like they want to get that shot of the wings just coming off the ground or they're doing whatever in takeoff. And you know what they're using? It ain't an SLR.
No.
They're doing it with either their camera phone or they're doing it with one of these point-and-shoot cameras, high-end
point-and-shoot. Although legally those should be turned off.
They should be turned off.
We're just saying. We're not encouraging that.
I've never posted any pictures like that myself, so I don't know what you're talking about. But yeah, I think the portability factor is huge. It's a huge downside for the SLR market is that it's not as portable. It's not as lightweight. You have to factor it in. I mean, I look at my camera bag, and my camera bag is as big as my suitcase.
Yeah.
It is a suitcase. It's its own dedicated suitcase. If I want to take all my camera gear on vacation, it's got its own bag.
On my last trip, my camera bag was larger than my suitcase.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the nature of the beast when you're dealing with SLRs.
And that's going to be the case in a few weeks when I go out to I'm going out to Maryland to shoot Brad Pitt's wedding. And
Are you serious?
I'm there for one day, and yet I'm going to have to take all my camera gear to shoot a whole wedding. So
you're shooting Brad Pitt's wedding?
Yes.
Wow, congratulations.
Well, it's not the Brad Pitt. It's a Brad Pitt. But that's neither here nor there. I'm shooting Brad Pitt's buddy. That's all I care about.
How did you get that gig? I mean, I know you're a good photographer and all, but... Okay, I'm not even going to go there. So that's the pros.
Follow
that's
my blog to learn more about that coming up.
Ooh, coming up. Carrie Garrison shoots Brad Pitt.
That's right. Yeah. It will be on my blog.
That's funny.
And it is a true statement. So there we go. Next.
Fun stuff, Gary. Fun stuff. Yeah, so that's the SLR's pros and cons. Moving into the third generation, we've kind of hinted at this kind of stuff already, but I think the big upsides are obviously the opposites of what we've talked about with the SLRs. The small form factor,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be very easy to take with you. The portability, while retaining the ability to swap out lenses.
The CMOS sensors.
The large size sensor. Yeah.
Video capabilities.
I think the frame rate. I think frame rate is huge because a lot of people, myself included, when I go out and I take a shot of something, especially if I'm shooting handheld, I'm almost always in burst mode.
Yeah, make sure one of them turns out.
And I'll take three shots of anything. And then usually it's the middle shot because there's a little bit of hand movement from the first shot and a little bit of hand movement as I'm letting go of the shutter, and that middle shot is usually fantastic. So frame rates on these new generation cameras I think are going to be huge, because then you can take a frame rate. You can take, you know, if you're taking 200 frames per second, one out of those is going to be shorter.
Maybe.
At least theoretically, assuming you've got autofocus.
If your issue is camera shake.
Right. If your issue is camera shake, one of those will be sharp. So anyway, other pros and cons. Carrie, your turn.
A lot of them have a lot of autofocus points. Now, their autofocus, as we mentioned, isn't as fast as we're seeing on current DSLRs, but it's also generally faster than point-and-shoots. But even something like that older Sony NEX-5 had 25 autofocus points.
Yeah.
So it does do a very good job at autofocus, even if it's just a little slower than what we may be used to with a DSLR, but it's faster than the compact. We haven't even talked about compact cameras. They might as well be dead at this point, I guess. You know, and then from the point and shoots, I mean, so it's a big step up from those, even though that's not quite there with the DSLRs. I'm going to call the autofocus a win in that category because of the number of autofocus points and the quality of job that the autofocus does, even if it's not ultra fast yet.
Okay, so a con then here, and this brings us back to that subject of lighting that we were talking about with third generation cameras, is that we don't have a lot of external lighting capabilities. Now, I think this was something that will probably be attenuated with time. You know, I think as the 3.1 generation comes out, or the 3.2 generation comes out of these cameras, you'll start to see the ability, because look at Nikon, they've got their commander mode. Mm-hmm. Inside their current SLRs, there's no reason why they couldn't incorporate that commander mode with their third-gen cameras. And I think Canon will probably introduce something like that in its subsequent generation of a camera bodies for us to purchase as well. And you'll see something like that where you can
Sony actually had said that the NEX-7 would be able to control the Sony external flashes.
Oh, there you go.
Yet in the production line, it did not. So now, whether that's a firmware change that they can do down the road, or it was a physical limitation that's preventing it, I don't know. But it certainly was on the roadmap to be done. So if Sony's already thinking about it, you know Nikon's thinking about it, you know Canon's going to do it when they come out with one of these. And Canon has filed patents for a mirrorless camera. So it's not that it's not going to happen. It's just a matter of time. And is it going to be a kind of an entry level one like a Micro Four Thirds, or is it going to be a replacement for the Canon G10, 11-12, and be kind of a prosumer point and shoot with?
Well, and see, that's the tricky thing with these, is because you never know how the camera vendors are really going to market these, you know, and that's the trick for them, right? Is to, I think that's part of the reason why. we're still seeing Canon stick with the SLRs because they don't want to introduce their next generation until they've sold out of as much inventory as possible in the SLR market. Because if they think about it, if they release a third generation camera now, what's going to happen to their Canon Rebel line of SLRs? You know, what's going to happen to that inventory that they need to sell off?
Well, I'm going to make a huge prediction here.
I'm going to throw.
You're going
to shoot Brad Pitt's wedding.
I am shooting Brad Pitt's wedding, but we'll discuss that later.
That's a different prediction.
Here's my prediction. Right.
Okay.
Wait till September.
Yeah. What's in September? Starts with a P.
Photokina. And I think that's where we're going to start seeing some game-changing devices.
Seriously, game-changing. And people throw that term around a lot, but I actually happen to agree with Carrie here. We're going to see some major upticks in the performance field for these third-gen cameras at Photokina.
I think,
totally agree with that.
I think on the DSLR side and on the mirrorless side, I think that's probably where we're going to see Canon's mirrorless camera. I think that's where we're going to see some major improvements in the DSLR market to maintain a competitive advantage over the mirrorless systems so that there is this reason to have one over the other.
Or both. I could see some professional category photographers. I'm thinking of like the Chase Jarvises out there, and the Zach Arias level of photographers, right? That have a little bit of extra discretionary income or revenue that can justify having something like this to do. Oh, we got to do a quick video interview. Throw that up.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, we don't have all our gear with us. Throw that up. That'll be a good photo interview. It'd be good enough quality video, good enough coming back into the mix there. So there's some that may have both.
Yeah. I'm seeing, you know, this huge, huge interest in aerial photography right now.
Oh, yeah.
And although it's illegal from a commercial point of view, which is a whole nother issue that we could do a whole show on, but there's a huge interest in it at the hobby level as well as at the commercial level. People who are doing it, but they're doing it illegally because it's so easy with these quadcopters and things that having these lightweight cameras that can take broadcast quality imagery and
video,
just be able to do some amazing shots that you'd never ever be able to afford to have a real helicopter come out and shoot for a real estate market to show off homes that are for sale, for doing damage inspection, for search and rescue, there's a plethora of uses of low-cost aerial photography, and these mirrorless cameras are an awesome match for that because they're lightweight and they can be put on these low-cost aerial vehicles. They just are an absolute perfect combination.
Yep. It's definitely going to be a huge uptick, and especially as people like us and others in the industry, and I'm not going to try to equate us to Robert Scoble and the Trey Ratcliffe of the world, because there is a distinction to be made there in terms of visibility.
Are they shooting Brad Pitt's wedding? I'm just saying.
Probably not the same Brad Pitt. Probably not the same Brad
Can they even say it? No, they can't.
Well, sure, everyone can say it.
Robert Evans can say it, because he did it.
I just said it. You're going to have to tell me about that offline. Well, hey, Carrie, thanks for stopping in and sharing with the listening audience your thoughts on the evolution of this third generation of cameras. Did we wrap it all up? Did we do pros and cons in both?
I think we did. This was a good conversation because you know, these things have been around for a while, but they're really starting to make an impact now. And
we haven't seen a lot of huge discussions either. So
no, and we both have been starting to get questions on it because the catchphrase, you know, mirrorless has really taken off, and yet, you know,
people don't know what it means.
No one cared when it was the Micro Four Thirds, but now all of a sudden the resolution's going up, the speeds are going up, everything's getting better on these things. It's time to start taking these things seriously.
Right, and I think that's what the trend is toward as well. As you know, everyone is taking a closer look at these cameras primarily because of what we've been talking about. They take fantastic quality images. Fantastic quality video. They're lightweight. You can still swap lenses out on that. You probably can't do it in flight on one of those remote RC helicopters, but but still, the ability to do that, I think that's a downside. It's both an upside and a downside. The ability to swap out lenses is good. The downside is that there aren't a lot of lens options out there yet. for this Micro Four Thirds or for the mirrorless camera. There are some, but you don't see the same array of lenses available that you do in the SLR marketplace. You can get the adapters, but there's not the same array natively. So I will throw that in as another possible limitation, depending on your perspective, for these mirrorless camera systems. So yeah, and we didn't I did have listener questions, but we are going way long. Surprise, surprise, like we always do.
Yeah.
So we're not going to have time to get to the listener questions. We'll get to that on the next podcast. But to round things out, Carrie, in case people don't know, where can they find you?
You can find me everywhere these days. CarrieGarrison.com. That's where I try and put all my common stuff. CameraDojo.com with our GoCast series we've been doing lately. And BlackBeltLighting.com. All your lighting products I got over there. So we got I'm all over the place. I'm going to be doing a lot of smug mugs coming up here. I got the OC smug mug. I got the San Francisco smug mug, the Denver one, Phoenix. So I'm going to be kind of all over the Midwest here.
You got to tell me about the Denver one. We got to talk more about that because that's something we had mentioned in the past and we need to cross our streams on that. I know Ghostbusters, you're not supposed to cross the streams.
Dude, that's a brutal reference right there.
I know. Most people are going to be like, what is he talking about?
Or in the ones that do, go, dude, that's not right.
Yeah. Well, depends on your frame of mind. If you come from our school of thought, we think Ghostbusters. So crossing the streams isn't, or at least let's cross communication. How about that?
There we go.
So we'll connect up while you're out here in Denver. Touch base. Your people will call my people.
Exactly.
So that's where you can find Carrie and all his latest digs going on. The other thing I'll throw out as a bone to Carrie, he doesn't know I'm about to do this, but I will definitely refer his black belt lighting. He got me a set of those triggers. They're still what I use, and I've used them all. Actually, that's not true. I've not used the Pocket Wizards. I had to return those. But aside from the Pocket Wizards, that is my wireless trigger of choice.
They work.
And that's having chose from them all. So they do work. They work phenomenally well. As long as you remember to turn them off when you're done, because when you go to your next shoot, the battery will be dead if you don't
turn it
off.
Here's a little safety point. Use rechargeable batteries.
Because
if you use alkalines and you leave them on, they can leak and destroy your electronics. So.
Oh. See, I only use the rechargeables. I didn't think of that.
There you go.
Good little tip for the day. And then for myself, of course, you can always find me at jason@canonblogger.com. Canonblogger.com is where this podcast goes, learning digital photography. We have the monthly contest. We've got a new ebook coming out in 2 weeks. A little teaser right here, the latest and greatest, the prequel to the DIY Legal Kit is finally going to presses. Yay! So that's going to be an exciting thing to come out. By the time you get this podcast, it'll probably be 1 week looking at our production and release dates for the show. So again, Carrie, thank you for coming on the show and talking about third generation cameras.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And we'll talk to you all next time with the Learning Digital Photography Podcast.